Very great pleasure to welcome you all here this evening to the Social Market Foundation LSE lecture, which this evening is going to be given by the Right Honourable the Lord Lawson of Blaby. I imagine he needs little introduction to you all, but let me just remind you that he has had an interesting and very varied career, which began at Oxford, and can I say that there's always chance to sort of correct these unfortunate omissions. We are very much into adult education now, so if ever you wanted another qualification, I'm sure we could come to an agreement. But however, after a PPE at Oxford, he became a journalist, a very distinguished journalist, worked in the Financial Times, city editor of the Sunday Telegraph, but always with an interest in politics as well as economics. He served as an advisor to Prime Minister Sir Alec Douglas Hume in the back rooms, if that's the right word, of the Conservative Party, and was, of course, then eventually elected an MP, Chancellor of the Exchequer from 1983-9, and had a very distinguished political career, which was extensively, I was about to say summarized, but I don't think that's really the right word, which was extensively publicized in his book, The View from Number 11, which was his memoirs, published in 1992. Just 10 years ago, he gave the Mays Lecture, an annual lecture, which only a few days ago, Sir Kenneth, the present Chancellor, the Right Honourable Kenneth Clark, gave. And we are all agog, I think it's fair to say, to hear what you have to say, Lord Lawson, in reflecting on your Mays Lecture 10 years ago. So it's with very great pleasure I invite you now to deliver the lecture, the Mays Lecture, 10 years on.
Well, Director, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much, Dr. Ashworth, for your kind introduction. And thank you too for the very kind plug for my book. That's always helpful. I hope you got the name. If I discover that it becomes compulsory reading for all students at this eminent institution, then I may indeed consider enrolling here. But I am seriously very greatly honoured to have been invited to deliver this Social Market Foundation LSE lecture, sponsored as it is by not one institution, but two. One relative newcomer, whose publications are making a valiant attempt to raise the lamentably low level of public debate on economic and social issues in this country. And, of course, the other, much more venerable, with a reputation second to none throughout the world. If my subject matter this evening, the Mays Lecture, 10 years on, seems a trifle self-regarding, I can only plead that it was chosen for me by the first of those two sponsors. For the benefit of those who may understandably be somewhat mystified by the meaning of the title, I should explain that a few months after I first became Chancellor in June 1983, I was invited to deliver the following year's Mays Lecture. And it seemed to me at the time to offer a useful opportunity relatively early on in my term of office, to provide a coherent restatement of the government's approach to the conduct of economic policy as I saw it, and I readily accepted the invitation. I duly delivered the lecture on the 18th of June 1984, and it received, certainly to me, it's a surprisingly large amount of press and other attention, both favourable and, of course, even more so unfavourable. And of all the many speeches I made during the 6 years and more of my chancellorship, it's probably the one I think that made the most lasting impact. indeed no less an authority than Robert Skidelsky, in a pamphlet he co-authored, which was published only last year, described it as having overturned the philosophic basis of the Keynesian revolution. So I suppose it was for that reason that Lord Skidelsky, and I'm sorry that he's not here today, but when I left the House of Lords, he was actively involved in the debate we're having on the age of consent for homosexuality. You can always tell what's going on in the House of Lords. If, as today, the car park is absolutely jam-packed and nobody can get in, then it means they're debating either sex or violence. Anyhow, I think it was for that reason that Robert Skidelsky suggested some time ago that I should mark the 10th anniversary of my May's lecture by offering some further reflections on it in the light of subsequent events. Although, and here we are, although the lecture ranged pretty widely, the essence was contained in the following two paragraphs, which I shall, if I may, quote. The conventional post-war wisdom was that unemployment was a consequence of inadequate economic growth, and economic growth was to be secured by macroeconomic policy, the fiscal stimulus of an enlarged budget deficit, with monetary policy to the extent that it could be said to exist at all, on the whole passively following fiscal policy. Inflation, by contrast, was increasingly seen as a matter to be dealt with by microeconomic policy, the panoply of controls and subsidies associated with the era of incomes policy. I went on. The conclusion on which the present government's economic policy is based is that there is indeed a proper distinction between the objectives of macroeconomic and microeconomic policy, and a need to be concerned with both of them. But the proper role of each is precisely the reverse of that assigned to it by the conventional post-war wisdom. It is the conquest of inflation, and not the pursuit of growth and employment, which is or should be the objective of macroeconomic policy. And it is the creation of conditions conducive to growth and employment, and not the suppression of price rises, which is or should be the objective of microeconomic policy. End of quotation. Now, of course, all economic policy declarations are to some extent creatures of their time. And what might be termed the May's doctrine was no exception. In June of 1984, inflation was below 5%, something that had never happened during the entire decade of the 1970s, whereas unemployment had reached the unheard-of heights of 3 million and was still rising. As a result, as Chancellor, I was under enormous pressure on all sides to shift the emphasis of economic policy, by which the critics inevitably meant monetary and fiscal policy, understanding no other, from curbing inflation to promoting growth and employment. I sought to use, therefore, the occasion of the May's lecture, not merely to explain why this would be mistaken, but equally to demonstrate that that did not mean that the government was indifferent to the level of unemployment. We did have a policy for the promotion of sustainable growth and employment through improved economic performance, but it consisted not of boosting demand, but of a battery of supply-side measures designed in one way or another to allow markets, not least the labour market, to work better. Now, whereas in some other countries, the May's doctrine might have been regarded as little more than a statement of the obvious, in the United Kingdom, 10 years ago, it was seen as startlingly novel, and by many as dangerously wrong-headed. To cite just one example, and there are many others, but I won't weary you with them, Gavin Davies, now one of the Treasury's panel of independent forecasters, the so-called wise men, went so far as to write a pamphlet, which was published in September 1985, which began with an attack on what he described as the intellectually assured May's lecture delivered in June 1984, and concluded with these words, and they were the conclusion of the entire pamphlet, and I quote them. Unemployment is now approaching the peak levels reached in the interwar recession. No less than in 1931-32, Britain needs a period of expansionary demand policy to bring unemployment down. Well, looking back, after an interval of 10 years, how has it all worked out? Despite the initial chorus of disapprobation of the kind I have just quoted, the Mays Doctrine was in fact adhered to by the government throughout the 1980s, and this is to a considerable degree continued into the 1990s. The result has been not merely a dramatic improvement in the UK's inflation performance compared with the 1970s, but a significant improvement in its growth performance too, comparing one complete cycle with another. Moreover, taking Britain's economic performance as a whole, there is unmistakable evidence that we have ceased to fall behind most of our major competitors in the developed world and have begun modestly to close the gap. If the improvement secured over the past 10 years is less marked than at one time it appeared to be, that is no reason for denying its existence altogether. It is, of course, perfectly true that the Mays Doctrine has not prevented the British economy, in common with pretty well every other economy in the world, from once again experiencing recession, but it was never suggested that it would. The plain fact is that the economic cycle is endemic, which means, incidentally, that all the current talk of no return to boom and bust is somewhat premature, to say the least. As experience throughout the world makes clear, abolition of the economic cycle is simply not within the power of any government to deliver. What is encouraging, however, is that unemployment not only peaked at a lower level during the UK recession of the early 90s than it did in the deeper and longer recession of the early 1980s, but that it started to fall at a very much earlier stage of the recovery. In short, whatever other problems the present government may be suffering from at this time, the overall performance of the economy is not one of them. That's not to say, of course, that all our problems are over. Not only does the present low level of inflation need to be locked in, as we sadly failed to lock in the low level of inflation reached in 1986, but there is clearly scope for considerable further improvement in the supply side of the economy. But that requires, I believe, no change of course, merely a continued application of the Mays Doctrine, admittedly something much easier said than done, but it has at least been shown that it can be done. Nonetheless, as I conceded earlier, all economic declarations are to some extent creatures of their time. And if I were delivering a similar lecture today, it would inevitably be in some respects different, reflecting changes that have occurred in the world economy over the past 10 years. The most obvious of these is the increasing concern worldwide, but particularly in Europe, about unemployment. This isn't, of course, a new problem. Unemployment in Europe first began to rise sharply during the 1970s, rose further during the recession of the early 1980s, and has remained high ever since. Even at the peak of the 1980s boom, the level of unemployment in the European community as a whole never fell below 8% and is currently over 11%. But although the unemployment problem that Europe faces today is not a new one, it took time for it to dawn that this was not some purely transitional phenomenon associated with the necessary eradication of 1970s-style inflation, or else a repetition of 1930s-style demand deficiency, which would be remedied by economic growth. It is only recently that it's become widely recognized that the high levels of unemployment, with all their damaging human and social consequences, are something much more intractable than this, the result of a major structural flaw in the economy, as policies and practices have become entrenched, which have the effect of pricing large numbers of men and women, and in particular the unskilled, out of work. Earlier this month, the OECD produced an unprecedentedly thorough study of unemployment on which it had been working for the past 2 years. It concluded that to deal with this structural problem, action would need to be taken in 8 areas, and I will list them in their own language, so you mustn't blame me for the language. Measures to enhance the creation and diffusion of technological know-how, measures to increase working time flexibility, measures to nurture an entrepreneurial climate, measures to increase wage and labour cost flexibility, measures to reform employment security provisions, measures to expand and enhance active labour market policies, measures to improve labour force skills, and measures to reform unemployment and related benefit systems. The fact that the OECD's analysis of the causes of the current high levels of unemployment and its suggested remedies have been accepted by all the 25 member governments does not mean that they are wrong. Indeed, I have little doubt that they point clearly in the right direction, and the problem will lie, as ever, in the implementation. One suggestive indication that they point in the right direction is the experience of this country, which of all the countries of Europe moved furthest in the direction now recommended by the OECD during the 1980s. Whereas during the first half of the 1980s, British unemployment was consistently above the average rate for the European community as a whole, since then it has been pretty consistently below it. But a more obvious example, of course, is the United States, where a conspicuously more flexible labour market has permitted the creation of jobs on a scale that Europe can only envy, with unemployment as a result well below European levels. As I mentioned at the start of this talk, concern over employment was also running high at the time of the 1984 Mays lecture. Indeed, UK unemployment then was higher than it is today, and the 2 years, exactly a decade apart, happened to represent broadly similar phases of the economic cycle, with GDP in 1984 exceeding for the first time the 1979 pre-recession peak, just as output this year is destined to exceed for the first time the 1990 pre-recession peak. What then of the treatment of unemployment in the Mays lecture? I have to admit that it was somewhat cursory. Beyond insisting that the creation of conditions conducive to employment was a matter not for fiscal and monetary policy, but for microeconomic policy, which I defined largely in terms of allowing markets to work better. I contented myself with drawing the lesson of the superior US experience and commenting that, and I quote, relatively free markets, the spirit of enterprise, and workers who prefer to price themselves into jobs rather than out of them are a powerful engine of employment. End of quotation. But I do think it's fair to say that the OECD analysis and prescription, although considerably more thorough than the rather exiguous description set out in the Mays lecture of 1984, and including, as the OECD's recommendations do, some microeconomic measures that go somewhat beyond merely allowing the labour market to work better, is nevertheless very much in the same spirit. There is, however, one aspect of the current employment debate which I did not refer to at all 10 years ago. It's nowadays a commonplace that the problem which in Europe manifests itself in high unemployment appears in the United States in the form of low and declining levels of pay for unskilled workers. I did touch on this in the Mays lecture when I pointed out that, and I quote again, over the past 10 years, that's the 10 years to 1984, of course, the total number of people in work in Western Europe has fallen. In the United States over the same period, the number of people in work has risen by over 15 million. This sharp contrast has not been the product of macro policy. It has been almost entirely due to the more efficient, competitive, innovative, and adaptive labor and goods markets in the United States. Over the past 10 years, the workers of Western Europe have seen their real earnings rise by around an eighth. Over the same period, their American counterparts have been prepared to accept a small reduction in real earnings. End of quotation. Now, a small reduction in real earnings, although unattractive to those involved, is in itself, I believe, a price well worth paying to bring down unemployment. What I did not consider, however, 10 years ago, was the possibility that this process might involve levels of pay for the least skilled that a fundamentally wealthy society would rightly consider too low to be acceptable. Whether this would be the case in Europe is not at present clear. As the OECD has pointed out, there is much to be done on a whole range of fronts. But should it threaten to be so, then the solution would have to include a significant extension of the UK family credit system to provide top-up payments to all those in work on very low pay. In this context, I would make just two further points. First, any extension of top-up benefits to those in work would fit very logically with the introduction of a system of workfare, which makes the payment of benefit to those of working age conditional on undertaking useful community work. And second, to contain the cost of such benefits, they would need to be heavily means-tested. The argument is often heard that the consequent withdrawal rate of benefit as earnings rose would have unacceptable disincentive effects is not a good one in this context. For the primary purpose of a scheme of this kind would be not economic, but human and social, to avoid the social stress and human distress of unnecessarily high unemployment. This is an entirely different matter from the need to improve overall economic performance by avoiding the disincentive of high levels of taxation further up the income scale. I identified earlier in this talk the increasing concern worldwide, but particularly in Europe, about unemployment as being one of the major changes that have occurred in the world economy over the 10 years since the 1984 Mays lecture. The other major change which I wish to discuss today is the advent of the global economy. For the most part, this has, if anything, reinforced the central message of the Mays lecture, but it has changed things in a number of respects. The most thoughtful criticism of the Mays lecture at the time was of my assertion that the sole objective of macroeconomic policy should be the conquest of inflation, the position still adhered to, as I understand it, by the present government. Some critics at the time argued for a much more ambitious objective, an active counter-cyclical use of fiscal and monetary policy to eliminate, or at least largely eliminate, the vagaries of the economic cycle. Others, less ambitiously, merely insisted that on some occasions it would be right to use macroeconomic policy to support economic activity. In a theoretical sense, I do have some sympathy with this last proposition, but for all practical purposes, it's not a significant qualification. For in the global economy of today, stimulatory macroeconomic action is most unlikely to be warranted unless the threat itself is worldwide, that is, if a global slump looms. If consumers and businessmen are reluctant to spend in one country alone, then export demand will fill the gap. Much the same applies if depression appears to be threatened by so-called debt deflation, which is usually associated with a credit crunch and a generally debilitated banking sector. Again, in the global economy of today, if the banking sector in one country is too weak to fulfill its role in the economy, strong banks from overseas will step in to fill the gap. But if the threat really is of worldwide slump, then worldwide and preferably coordinated monetary relaxation would indeed be the right response. However, that is not the case today, nor has it been at any time since the 1930s, which are quite a long time ago now. I have no sympathy whatever, however, for the much more ambitious notion that the objective of macroeconomic policy should be to iron out the business cycle. There is overwhelming practical evidence that economies, certainly free economies, move and always do move in cycles. There are rival explanations of why this should be so. But whatever the explanation, the evidence of an albeit irregular cyclical pattern in all countries and throughout recorded history is painfully evident. The unsuccessful Keynesian attempt to abolish the cycle by the active use of fiscal policy has merely, over a period of years, left many countries with a higher level of public spending, public deficits, and public debt than they are comfortable with. As for the equally unsuccessful attempt to allow monetary policy to be abused for the same purpose, this was a major cause of the inflationary disaster of the 1970s, not all the poison from which, even now, has been entirely drained from the system. But if the inability of governments to steer economies along an impossibly straight line by the active use of macroeconomic policy has been demonstrated time and again in the past, as indeed it has been in all countries, how much more is this true in the global economy of today? Recent events have demonstrated all too clearly the power of global financial markets to impose their will on any national government that is suspected, rightly or wrongly, of financial imprudence or weakness of resolve in the battle against inflation. So far as the conduct of monetary policy is concerned, there has always been a tension inherent in the fact that while short-term interest rates are largely determined by the monetary authorities, long-term rates are largely determined by the financial markets. Recent events in the bond markets have demonstrated very clearly that globalization has tilted the balance of power inherent in this tension in favor of the markets and against the authorities. This does not, as I see it, undermine the authorities in the sustained conduct of the battle against inflation. Indeed, although it may do that sometimes, more often than not, it will reinforce them. But what it clearly does do is drive the final nail in the coffin of those who believe, against all the evidence as I've mentioned, that macroeconomic policy can be fine-tuned to eliminate the vagaries of the cycle. If macroeconomic policy is, as I argued in the Mays lecture 10 years ago, to be devoted to the suppression of inflation, this is clearly preeminently a matter for monetary policy. One simple practical indication of this is the existence of independent central banks throughout the world, from Germany to New Zealand, charged with responsibility for the maintenance of price stability, with their only weapon as monetary policy. It is a thousand pities that the present government does not feel strong enough to confer independence within an appropriate statutory framework on the Bank of England. I have argued this case for some considerable time now, and it has been more fully set out with admirable lucidity in the Rolle report published by the Centre for Economic Policy Research last year. The halfway house alighted upon by the present government of publishing the minutes of the regular monetary meetings between the Chancellor and the Governor is an interesting innovation. But not only is it an inadequate substitute for central bank independence, at a later stage in the cycle, if the minutes are to represent an honest account of the discussions that take place, they could have a detrimental effect on the credibility of the authorities' decisions in the financial markets, which would outweigh any advantage derived from this new arrangement. No doubt, in these circumstances, the solution will be found in financial bowdlerization, which further underlines that this is no substitute for independence. But whether one favours central bank independence or not, the important fact is that in a number of countries it exists. And it could not exist were it not for the fact that monetary policy, the sole policy instrument within the control of central banks, is not merely necessary, but also sufficient to discharge the responsibility of curbing inflation. What, then, is the macroeconomic role of fiscal policy? This, too, has been affected by globalization. 10 years ago, it was possible to argue, as I did in the Mays lecture, that if the government sought to finance its expenditure by increased borrowing rather than by taxation, and I quote, the markets might not believe that the government was prepared to allow real interest rates to rise to the extent necessary to persuade people to accept a higher stock of government debt. they might instead expect increased monetization of the deficit, with the result that inflationary expectations and nominal interest rates would tend to rise. End of quotation. The globalization of financial markets means that this statement applies with its full force only to the industrialized world as a whole, where a global rise in budget deficits would undoubtedly lead to a rise in global inflationary expectations along the lines I indicated. By contrast, a rise in the deficit of one country alone can nowadays be financed by a very much smaller rise in interest rates than was formerly the case, thanks to the ability to attract overseas funds. But this presents a whole range of new problems, not least the fact that a rise in net inflows into the capital account of the balance of payments must of necessity imply a corresponding deterioration in the current account, which can lead to an intensification of protectionist pressures. Taken all in all, then, the effect of globalization has been not to weaken in any sense the overall case for budgetary rigor. Indeed, ideally a balanced budget, as was achieved in this country in the 1980s. But what it has done is to make the case rather more in global than in purely national terms, with the result that the limitation of budget deficits has now become, or should have become, a proper matter for the agenda of international economic cooperation. In the course of this brief and necessarily far from complete discussion of the impact of globalization on the economy and on the conduct of economic policy, I have indicated ways in which it has rendered governments, which ever since the war have been in any case attributed with greater power to influence the course of economic events than they in fact possess, to make them even more powerless. Does this matter? I believe that from one point of view, and maybe even on balance, it is a matter for some satisfaction. For whether governments are seen as powerless or not depends in the last resort on what economic policy is or should be about. Experience shows that the conduct of economic policy can have a profound effect, for good or ill, on the long-term prosperity of a nation and its people. Moreover, although the task is never easy, we also know from experience throughout the world, perhaps more clearly now than at any time in the past, what the secret of success is. By contrast, experience not merely in this country, but throughout the developed world, demonstrates clearly that we cannot eradicate the business cycle, the alternation of boom and recession, and indeed the short-term fluctuations in the rate of inflation that tend to be associated with the cycle. Yet paradoxically, despite these two well-established facts, the focus of economic debate in this country, and I suspect in most other developed countries, is almost exclusively on the short-term vagaries of the business cycle, about which policy makers can in reality do very little, and as I have argued, perhaps even less today in the globalized economy in which we live, rather than on the conditions for improved economic performance over the longer term, about which both nationally and internationally much can be done. The 1984 Mays Lecture sought, among other things, to highlight the hitherto somewhat neglected area, certainly in terms of the public debate, of microeconomic policy, and to stress its importance. And in this area, globalization has in no sense whatever rendered governments powerless. Indeed, it has in a number of ways served to highlight the need for governments to refocus their efforts in this direction. So perhaps, looking back with the benefit of hindsight, the main thing wrong with the 1984 Mays Lecture was that it did not go far enough. Thank you.
Would you like, if you'd like to stay there, Lord Lawson? Lord Lawson has very kindly agreed to take questions. He didn't actually say answer them, but he kindly agreed to take them. And I'd be grateful if those who would like to ask him a question could just put their hands up, and then I'll take you all in sequence. Yes, let's start. Yes.
They're always the most difficult ones to answer.
Standing between unemployment and inflation, say between devil and deep sea, and you are asked to choose to go one side, what would you say? What is right?
I would say, read my Mays lecture of 1984. the whole point of which was to show that the policies against inflation and the policies against unemployment, or the policies to create the conditions conducive to higher employment, go together in parallel, because you use macroeconomic policy to curb inflation and you use microeconomic policy trying to improve the supply side of the economy, all these sorts of measures, trying to free it up and so on, to create conditions which will lead to more jobs. That was the message of the 1984 Mays lecture. Perhaps you were not around to hear it at the time.
No, I read it and I know about
that. Yes.
I ask a very simple, straightforward question. What do you decide, opt for, between the two devils?
Well, that's like saying which would you prefer, which would you opt for, sleeping or eating. Most of us do both.
On that happy note, Christopher.
I'd like to ask whether you don't think that the government actually failed to follow the Mays prescriptions in the later 1980s, because there was, in fact, a substantial expansion of demand, relaxation of both monetary and fiscal policy, financial deregulation and tax cuts, whatever their motive, had the effect of increasing demand to the point where unemployment was, of course, sharply reduced. Growth was increased, but it was unsustainable. And I just wonder whether you feel that your advice was being followed, and also whether what you said about the exception to your rule for global slump wasn't, in fact, going on after the October 1987 crash. Was there not then a conscious use of monetary policy in order to overcome the fear of global slump, which turned out, in retrospect, to have been rather exaggerated?
Let me answer both of your questions, Christopher. If I forget one while I'm answering the other, please remind me. Your account of what happened in the 1980s, although the widely held, is, I believe, largely inaccurate. There was certainly a huge upsurge of demand, which led to an upsurge in inflation in the late 1980s. Not as big an upsurge of inflation as many people think, but nevertheless, it policy went. Everything's moving here. Off track. As I indicated, it is not within the power of government to fine-tune the economy. I'm not saying that mistakes were not made, but even if mistakes hadn't been made, perhaps mistakes are always made anyway. But even if mistakes hadn't been made, you would have some cycle. You always do. And you can't control it. Well, it wasn't a relaxation of monetary policy. We had, throughout that period, real interest rates of 6% or more. We had higher real interest rates than any other country in the G7. We had higher real interest rates than we'd had any other time in our history. As for the fiscal policy, you point to the tax cuts, but you can't just look at one side. We had a unprecedented control of public expenditure, as a result of which the budget deficit was eliminated altogether, and we were in surplus. And even if you cyclically correct, it was a tight fiscal policy. What you did have, however, was associated, as you implied, by from deregulation, but nobody predicted this, you had an explosion of credit. But there is no way, known to me, and there's no way I believe anybody else knows, whereby you can fine-tune bank lending. Bank lending, too, depends a lot on the prudence or imprudence of bankers. It depends also on the mood. the state of optimism. You can't fine-tune expectations. You can't fine-tune optimism and pessimism. Keynes, as you will recall in the general theory, stated, and I think I quote him accurately, that a boom is a condition when optimism is so great that it can be controlled by no level of interest. It overcomes a level of interest so high that in cooler times they will be effective. And that is these mood swings happen, and it is extremely difficult to control them, and in fact I don't think you can fine-tune them. So that was what happened in the 1980s. As for the specific event of 1987, it is right that there was some slight relaxation of policy following Black Monday and the Wall Street crash of the 22nd October 1987. That was really to deal with what looked like a crisis of confidence. It wasn't, I think those of us in the G7 who were involved in this and the finance ministers who were involved in this at the time, were worried that there would be a complete collapse of confidence. I don't know whether you remember the mood at that time. Perhaps you do, but it was very black indeed. And so there was, and that was why the action incidentally was concerted, because we felt that the sight of us all working together would have this psychological impact on confidence, would reassure people in a way that if people had acted separately might not have been the case. Whether we were right to do this or not, it is difficult to say. Certainly, with the benefit of hindsight, it was relaxing monetary policy slightly, just at the very, in the final stages of a great boom, which doesn't look very sensible. What we don't know, of course, given the mood at the time, is what would have happened if no action at all had been taken, because psychology does play a very important part in economic events, in the case of the cycle, and optimism can turn to gloom very, very quickly. In fact, it didn't, and optimism perhaps became even greater, because people, having survived that with no adverse effects, became even more overconfident. But as I say, these things are very difficult to handle.
David Wills.
I think that a government can do very little. There are all these other factors, as you say, David. One is that it may well be that a economy which is going through a phase of rapid expansion is more likely to have a pronounced cycle. It may also be that that a deregulated economy, particularly when financial markets and credit markets are deregulated, has greater volatility, is more likely to show a pronounced cycle than one which is much more controlled. But it may equally be, and I would believe it to be so, although I can't demonstrate it, that the benefits of having a deregulated economy outweigh the disadvantages of having a more pronounced cycle. It may again be that the amplitude of the cycle is linked to the length of the preceding upswing. If the upswing goes on for a very long time, as the upswing of the 1980s did go on for an exceptionally long time, then people are inclined to believe that it, much more inclined to believe that it's going on forever. I think this is the sort of thing that, that Keynes had in mind, of this feeling of optimism that is engendered. I think that perhaps what governments can do paradoxically most to reduce the amplitude of the cycle is to tell people that the cycle is inescapable. Then they will not believe that things are going to go on and on forever. Then they will be more cautious and more prudent, and it is the excessive optimism which is the trigger, which then subsequently leads to the harsh cold reality setting in later on.
Yes.
Falling interest rates over a long period of time, all of which on the May's lecture doctrine you would think will spark inflation. And we've had very low inflation, and that's for microeconomic reasons, and we've had considerable competition in both labour and product markets. So isn't that bit of the doctrine now 10 years later out of date?
Well, I don't know. I think that I would need some persuading of that particular thesis. I think that inflationary expectations take a long time to come down once they have become embedded, and that there has been the very much lower inflationary expectations that there are today, which is associated with a slightly lower level of inflation than we had in the 1980s, I don't think would have been possible had there not been the lowering of inflationary expectations that occurred during the 1980s. And that long and sustained period in which you had a government pursuing, to the best of its ability, an anti-inflationary policy and keeping that right at the forefront for macroeconomic policy and making numerous speeches about it and so on. And I think that that meant that what tends to happen is that obviously inflationary forces are less in a recession, and there's nothing microeconomic about that. But that came about this time in a period when the inflationary expectations had already been greatly reduced, and that was considerably that helped considerably. So I think that I'm not at all clear what you mean by microeconomic measures bringing down inflation. I don't think that has been. There have been microeconomic measures. I think it has been the climate, certainly, which has, for the various reasons I've indicated, meant inflationary expectations are lower. It has meant that businessmen's behavior is very different because they've been living in a very different climate than the climate in which they were living in the 1970s and the 1960s. Maybe that's to some extent microeconomic, but it was created by the framework of macroeconomic policy, those attitudes. And so I think that the assignment of the roles of macroeconomic policy, particularly monetary policy and microeconomic policy, to the one to inflation, the other to conditions conducive to improved economic performance, better growth over the long term, better employment prospects and so on, is right. As for the fiscal policy, the budget deficits and all that, which you also alluded to, as I indicated, I think that I don't believe that anyhow that but fiscal policy, if it is not accommodated by monetary policy, is either inflationary or deflationary anyway. Certainly, I mean, within the constraints that it's likely to fall within anyway, you would have to do something which is totally inconceivable and wholly disruptive to have a macroeconomic effect from changes in fiscal policy. That is why, incidentally, it was always clear to me that all this talk that was in the press and among some other commentators not so long ago, that the tax increases, quite big tax increases in the two budgets of last year, would knock the recovery on the head, was nonsense. Nothing of the sort would happen. And indeed, nothing of the sort, all the indications are that nothing of the sort is happening.
Yes.
I'd just like to ask a question. You talked about the OECD and you talked about climate.
That's a very interesting question, and I wish I knew the answer. I think it is true to say, yes, it is largely accepted now in the Conservative Party, but not universally, not entirely, not unanimously, even within the Conservative Party. But I think within the sort of the majority, certainly the thoughtful members of the Conservative Party, I think accepted. The Labour Party, it's difficult to say. So far, I don't think the Labour Party has changed much, I have to say. But I do think that Tony Blair is quite different from any previous leader of the Labour Party. And it seems to me quite possible that, if it seems likely, he becomes leader of the Labour Party, the Labour Party will change in a way that so far it has not done.
Well, Lawson, you mentioned in your speech the example of the United States, its labour market policies emphasizing deregulation, which were more successful in terms of creating jobs than European policies.
Yeah, they never really had so much regulation in the first place. Well, it is, I think, very difficult to give you an absolutely dogmatic answer to that. I mean, what we have at the moment in the world, I think one of the things we have in the world, certainly, is a mismatch in the supply and demand for skilled and unskilled labour. There will always be a demand for unskilled labour, but at the moment, the supply of unskilled labour is very much in excess of that demand. It is rather the reverse is the case for skilled labour, where there is a demand in excess of the supply. And so what you see is, in both cases, this reflected in the price level. Well, what ought to happen in a well-functioning market, of course, is this provides a very great incentive both for people to acquire skills and a very great incentive to, indeed, for employers to train people, because they're worth so much more to them if they are fully trained. I think there's a very important role for government, incidentally, particularly in this country, where our biggest weakness, and it's a weakness which has been in existence for a very, very long time, is the lamentably low standard of education. I'm not talking about the LSE, you'll be glad to hear, or indeed institutions of higher education generally. It's in the schools where the standard is very low, compares very badly with most other major advanced countries. And education is tremendously important, particularly in a world where skills required can change. It's not a matter of learning a particular skill. It's having the capacity to acquire skills. And without a good basic education, and therefore subsequently new skills very often, without a good basic education, that is extremely difficult. So I think that's a very important role for government, which I think has been accepted by government, but it takes a long time before you see any results. But as I say, in a reasonably functioning market, over time this mismatch between the, as I say, the supply and demand, skilled labour, unskilled labour, ought to sort itself out, and therefore I would hope that the sort of payments that I suggested might be necessary would be necessary only for a transitional period.
Yes, I think we'd better have this the last question.
I miss both the excitement and the aggro. The aggro I don't mind missing.
Well, Lord Lawson, you've really done us proud, I think, tonight, and on behalf of all in the audience, I'd like to thank you very much for a fascinating glimpse, not so much of how you would rewrite the Mays lecture, since I suspect you wouldn't actually rewrite it very much at all, but a fascinating glimpse of how you think still about economic affairs, and I think what Wordsworth called recollections in tranquility. I think only fair to say that across my desk today came a press release from UCAS, one of the university's new admissions service, which had in it two very interesting facts, which I think go some way to bearing out one of the points you were making. In the 80s, that's from academic year 1881 to 1991, the number of undergraduates in British universities went up by over 50%, and the number of postgraduates went up by 80%. There was also on my desk today another press release from another part of government, which proudly said that graduate unemployment had gone down by more this year than it's ever gone down in the last 10 years. So I think that combination of rapidly falling graduate unemployment coupled with very significant increases in both the number of postgraduates and undergraduates go some way to showing that on the skill front, at least with that one-third of our population who now go to higher education, the battle that you were describing about employment and skills is, if not being won, then at least victories, modest victories, are being achieved. What that does, of course, for the two-thirds who don't go to higher education, at least in UK, remains to be seen. But enough of this highfalutin stuff. It now falls to be my very pleasant duty of inviting you all upstairs to the Senior Common Room for a reception. Thank you very much again, Lord Lawson.